This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Harry's. It's for guys like you and me, frankly, who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now. Go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase by entering the coupon code Majority Report when you check out.
The Majority Report with Sam. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, July 17th, 2014. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. And we are broadcasting live from the Kobo Center in Detroit, Michigan at Netroots Nation 2014, ladies and gentlemen. Today on the program, a cavalcade of guests from across the entire Netroots Nation, as it were. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully the sound is good. This is a good time for Matt and Michael to be telling me that sound is good on their end. And Michael just told me, is that me or did the show just cut out? Matt says it's good. Always helpful to give you getting. Hopefully we're good. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be having a lot of guests on the show today. I am here at Netroots Nation for what I believe is the ninth year in a row. And which is both fun and disturbing for me. The first Netroots Nation was, of course, in Las Vegas, Nevada, and it was at that time Yearly Kos. Started out of some diarists on the Daily Kos, and we broadcasted live from the Majority Report. Was the first radio program ever to emanate out of Netroots Nation or Daily or Yearly Kos. At that time, of course, we were in a skybox overlooking a huge, I don't know what to call it, a huge convention hall. And maybe we'll have Josh Orton on the program a little bit later, look back on that. And the conference has changed. And what I'm hoping to do over the next 2 days is both have some people on who can reflect on the conference itself and the broader movement, and also talk about specific issues. It's just an opportunity for me to get in touch with people. Interesting year in regarding attendance, and you know, we will talk to folks about that as well. Also, let me just start off by saying an unbelievable story that has just broken. A Malaysian Airlines passenger plane with 295 people aboard was shot down by a surface-to-air missile in Ukraine near the Russian border. Seems to be multiple reports. The airline, of course, is the same airline where where one of their flights essentially disappeared over the Indian Ocean in March. This plane, this Malaysian Airlines flight, emanated from Amsterdam. Its last known position was over Ukrainian airspace. There is some question as to whether or not Ukrainian rebels shot it down. This is a breaking story, and of course, I'm out of my normal news rhythm right now, and so it's that is all I can tell you. We will I will continue to give you updates as we know them. Of course, hostilities continue between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Children hit on a beach. Palestinians killed. They were playing on a beach, and Israeli missiles ended up killing them. I mean, it just goes on. Perhaps we will talk about that over the course of the next day or two here at Netroots Nation. There are folks here who obviously agitate and report on such things. So we will dig into that too as the days progress. What we're going to do is take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan. Also coming up over the next 2 days, Stephanie Kelton, Shanna Bellows, Charlie Pierce. We'll be talking hopefully to Marcy Wheeler and to the PCCC folks and the Credo folks. We'll be talking hopefully to many more people. But right now, going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. As soon as I figure out some of the music. Oh, here we go.
Driving on night, you could be a shadow beneath the streetlight behind my home. Driving on night, I sure miss you. Past the motel, looking at the pines.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Harry's. Look, it's no secret, I'm not a big fan of shaving. All right. I don't like to shell out all those bucks for those fancy shavers and those big plastic things that, like, you need some type of, you need to be like a safe cracker to get those things out. They cost $4. It's true. They cost $4 for a razor, and then they hook you in. You got to pay tons of cash to get new razors. Well, Harry's is a company that has basically taking this horrible experience of buying overpriced shavers, and they've turned it on its head. I no longer am buying those cheap disposable razors. Harry's was founded by two guys, one of whom was the co-founder of Warber Parker, the guys who make the glasses, and I'm wearing a pair of those right now. So I figured I'd give it a try. It's basically all about less is more with Harry's. You get a great shave. They got great shaving gel to go with it. Simply go over to harrys.com and use the coupon code MAJORITYREPORT to get $5 off your first purchase. That's harrys.com, promo code MAJORITYREPORT. I got the Winston set, and I got it engraved so that Nikki doesn't use it. It was shipped to my door. I like the look of it. I like the feel of it, and it gives me a great shave. Check it out. We want to thank Harry's for their support of the Majority Report. That's harrys.com, promo code MAJORITYREPORT.
Driving on nine, I'll sure look pretty. Carson City, walking down the aisle. Driving on nine, does Daddy have a shotgun? He said he'd never need one.
All right, folks, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I am, as you know, live from the Kobo Center at Netroots Nation, and it is a pleasure to welcome to the program one of my favorite guests. I think everyone knows that. We will not be talking about the Postal Service as a banking institution, although, with that said, and I know he's looking at me with shock, he will be delivering a panel on it here at Netroots Nation. Of course, I am talking about the regular contributor, the Financial Times.
Not the Financial Times, the Fiscal Times.
The Fiscal
Times. Financial Times is heavy-duty publication.
Well, Fiscal Times is, as far as I'm concerned, any publication that publishes you is a heavy-duty publication.
There you go.
And also Salon and et cetera, et cetera, all across the New Republic. As always, you can go to daviddayantumblr.com. David Dayan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's start with the meta. The meta story here of Netroots Nation. And then I want to talk about this Cuomo story because you are obviously well versed in the mortgage stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, we've only been here for 12 hours. You and I first met 25 years ago.
Yes.
Down the road in Ann Arbor on a student film, but that's a whole nother story.
A whole nother.
But we reconnected at Netroots Nation, I guess it was 9 years ago.
Yeah, at the first one.
At the first one. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about last night was how much this has changed, Netroots, and also sort of the absence of... Let's talk about for a moment who's not here. Now, this is very... I'm going to say right up front, this is very myopic in some ways. But it wasn't... This would not be a myopic perspective 9 years ago. In other words, when this conference first started, it was really a way for bloggers to meet one another who had basically developed relationships over the internet.
Right.
And at the time, the biggest blogs, of course, was the Daily Kos. It was the yearly Kos, the conference.
Yeah.
But Fire Dog Lake, Eschaton, Atreosa site, Digby at Hullabaloo, Crooks and Liars, what else? I think it was Open Left maybe at the time. So it was Stoller and Bowers, and maybe Sirota, I think, was there at that time. There was a couple others, but they escaped me at the moment. I'm not sure. But those are certainly the big ones in terms of traffic. None of those people, short of Marcos, are here.
Chris Bowers is here. But
Chris Bowers
he
is
works
here,
at
but
Daily
he now
Kos
works
now.
At Daily Kos. But Atreos is not here. Digby is not here. John Amato is not here. Jane Hampshire, not here. I don't think she's been in a couple of years. Glenn Greenwald, who's at Unclaimed Territory at the time.
He's got other things to deal with.
He's got other things to deal with. He's in Brazil. And I think to a large extent it's sort of coincidental because it's not like but at the same time a lot of those outsider voices are not what this conference is about anymore. It's really more about organizations in some way.
Yeah, I mean, and we've talked about this at prior Netroots events that this is
It really feels like it's crystallized this year.
Yeah,
in some way.
Could be. I mean, it has become sort of a trade show for the professional left. Progressive organizations on a variety of issues. They have booths in the exhibit hall, and they are a driving force on many of the panels, and they send their people, presumably on expense accounts, to come to Netroots Nation and have a good time and network. You see this in a lot of fields. It's not really any different than CPAC, which is, you know, a movement-based organization. And you still have, I would say, hundreds, if not thousands, of ordinary bloggers, people who are on the diaries of Daily Kos, who still do show up. It's a big enough event that you could probably make a lot of generalizations and be correct in those generalizations. But it has changed. And I mean, part of it is that we're just old timers.
Well, that's the other thing, is that there is this sort of like, you know, we are the ants trying to explain an elephant, essentially. But with that said, I mean, I do think, at the very least, to the extent that we make a generalization, that this is no longer about outsiders. It's not, which is not to say that this is the establishment here, but it is. It has been professionalized in many respects.
And I mean, I think that if 9 years ago you said, even though there were significant people who came to sort of kiss the ring at the first Netroots Nation, if you flashed forward 9 years and said, well, at the ninth in Netroots Nation, there's going to be the Vice President of the United States, Chuck Schumer, is going to show up and give a few words. I think people would have a little bit of surprise at that it was people would be welcome.
But in 2007, when it was only sort of like 2 years into it, there was all the presidential candidates, or the Democratic ones. You know, you had Edwards and Clinton.
I think there's a different pitch, though, because at that time, it was about those people ingratiating or attempting to ingratiate themselves to a community that they felt represented a certain block of voters.
Right.
Now I feel like these are the people, you know, they're addressing a community that they work with on policy, on legislation, or it's just that they are an interest group. And maybe that doesn't sound like it's the same thing, but I think it's voters versus interest group blocks, which are different.
Right, right. And I think that I think there was also a sense back in 2007, like, wow, this is a burgeoning sort of, nobody knew quite what this would be as, and you know, I mean, I guess there's a half-life for every sort of a moment, yeah. I mm-hmm. guess, and that moment has gone to a large extent, it's a function both of what has happened to sort of online unaffiliated advocacy and what has also happened to sort of like big media, because as much as anything else, I think like the bloggers were about were not so much about political force but about taking back a certain narrative, or it was more media oriented in retrospect maybe than it was politically about a political force. And as and then the blogosphere, as we no longer call it, sort of split into two directions, some who followed a media track and then some who followed like an online advocacy track. And this is more about that online advocacy trend.
Right. I mean, there's definitely been a splintering of that community online. First of all, because it was simply too costly to expect people to do this as a hobby. There was a certain professionalization.
Yeah, you can only do that
existence.
In the context of national radio. Is the only expectation where people are going to just, it's going to be a hobby.
You know, here, hobby. I don't know if the audience has heard about Sam's.
This audience has.
They're,
oh, yes.
They're aware that you asked for way too much money and you asked for all these luxuries, even though they were helping you with all manner of largesse.
I told the story of, I called my buddy John Benjamin. who was aware that I was doing the show and that I wasn't going to get paid initially. And I called him and I said, like, I've just been told basically I'm supposed to do this until sometime in January 2015 for no money ever. And he's like, you know what? You should have let me negotiate this, because I could have actually got them to allow you to work for 14 months for no pay instead of 7 or 8.
He is a shrewd negotiator.
Oh, yes, very good.
But I mean, what you're talking about is, it speaks to a larger concern. There's just not a lot of money in this, whatever it is, online advocacy thing.
Right.
Not enough for people who want to eat to continue on that track. And so there has been that splintering. A lot of people have gone on to form their own websites and their own media conglomerates. There's money in doing that. In online media, there is money. But it requires a certain level of professionalization that has changed
right.
the landscape. I mean, look at what Ezra Klein is doing at Vox, or what Nate Silver is doing at 538. Clearly, there's money in this, but
not necessarily in just political advocacy. I mean, they've moved on.
Exactly. That's my point. Yeah. So, you know, it requires a different pitch and maybe even a less of a partisan cast
yes.
to everything. So that has certain and so what do you have left? You have professional organizations who specialize in advocacy and research and things like that, and that's what is reflected here at Netroots Nation. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing, although we lament it maybe because of the energy and spirit of the first few events.
Right.
But it's not necessarily something that's lamentable. I mean, it's probably a prerequisite to having a robust liberal movement
That's right.
infrastructure.
That's right.
Is to do that. So
I'm asking Scott if he can go grab me some food that is provided, in which I wanted to make a point. The snack bar is provided for, what is it called?
By Ready for Hillary. Pat.
Ready for Hillary. And so it just gives you a little bit of a notion.
Once again, yeah.
Yeah, of how this group is perceived here, I guess, on some level. But yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, I lament it in the way that I lament like a good sort of alternative comedy room that
right.
existed and could only exist in
right.
that form for, you know, whatever.
Now this is
months.
The punchline rather than the Holy City Zoo.
Right, or, right, you know. Exactly,
right.
exactly. And it still functions for me in a very similar fashion, but I feel like I'm a little bit more marginal.
Mm-hmm.
My experience, or you know, that idea of like getting together with bloggers, is a little bit more marginal in terms of what the experience of other people here is.
Yeah,
I think it's more about groups coordinating, like how can we do this message, or what are best practices to do X, Y, or Z, or
right.
or whatever it is. And so, all right, let's and you know, I hope the audience will indulge. You know, more of this conversation, because it is interesting to see sort of where we're at, and it, you know, I couldn't in a million years tell you what the singular mission is of this event in a way that I think I could have 8-9
right.
years ago.
I think that's a function of the progressive movement itself, such that it is. I think there's a lot of ennui and a lot of questioning of where that movement's place is
yeah.
in the political environment at this point. There hasn't been for years now really that signature touchstone. You know, I don't think that the movement has survived the shift from an oppositional stance into going into government and how to pitch or how to
right.
pressure, continue to work on the issues when you have a Democrat in the White House as opposed to a Republican.
So
that's a problem.
Actually, I think, I want to talk about this Cuomo story because it's at least loosely affiliated to that theme. And I want to also talk about, you had a piece about what may or may not be developing in the education sphere, in union education. But,
yeah.
But first, give us a brief rundown. And obviously, this is going to be a story that I'm going to pursue. But Cuomo the Lesser is in the news today. Do tell.
So Justin Elliott, who's a great reporter at ProPublica, put together this piece. And it spent quite a long time on it, uncovering that when Andrew Cuomo was the state attorney general, he brought on a longtime aide of his, a longtime confidant of his, to help him work through mortgage fraud investigations. Now, at this time in 2007, these were just getting off the ground. We were starting to figure out that these bonds that were ubiquitous in the industry, that banks were packaging together mortgages and selling them as securities to investors all over the world, and they were starting to turn sour as the housing bubble right in 2007 started to collapse. And there was starting to be information coming out in various circles that these bonds were put together improperly. And so Cuomo...
And at that time, too, if I remember correctly, there was a general awareness like, hey, there's something problematic in the origination of these loans.
Right.
We had ninja loans,
and
people were starting to talk about, you know, like, there were no documents, liar's loans.
Basically, anyone with a pulse could get funded
with a loan. Right, and people are sort of getting pushed into these things.
And New York was at the center of that because all of these mortgage-backed securities were in large part based on New York state trust law, either New York or Delaware. So if you were the Attorney General of New York or the Attorney General of Delaware, you were well-positioned to pursue cases over the potential corruption of these mortgage bonds. So Cuomo brings on this confidant who he worked with at HUD. The guy was named Howard Glazer. And he brought him on to consult about the various investigations he was going through in 2007. It turned out that at the same time he brought this guy on, Howard Glazer was a lobbyist for the mortgage industry. And he represented clients that ended up doing immunity deals with Andrew Cuomo for investigations that eventually amounted to nothing and got scuttled. So here we have Andrew Cuomo, the point person very early in the game, someone who could have made a serious difference in these mortgage investigations, could have blown it wide open very early on, enlisting the advice of literally a lobbyist for this industry.
All right, let me play devil's advocate.
Okay.
You say this guy's a lobbyist for the bankers. Okay, that may well be. But who better to deputize than somebody who's in
you
the game?
You have to be someone on the
inside.
I mean, think
inside. About this. Yeah, like the Wild West, right?
Right.
You're going after whatever. The old timers gang, and you want one of those guys in the gang.
Well, this is what was said about the Obama administration's economic team, right? They knew how the economy was blown up, and so they were best positioned to fix
it. Right. All right. Well, here's my alternate devil's advocate, and that is, come on. How could Cuomo have gone after the bankers when he knew he was going to be running for governor and he was going to need their donations?
Right. It's a good point.
Okay.
It's a good point. But the corruption goes so deep that apparently Glazer, who, as I said, was advising Cuomo on these investigations, then went back to his clients and hosted a conference call to describe what Cuomo was doing in the investigations to the industry.
Well,
deliberately,
it is much better for the subjects of investigations
to know
what the investigators are doing. That way they can cooperate better.
You do have an airtight case here. So,
all right. Well, this
I
is a story.
To continue.
This is a story, obviously, that's going to get more attention because the way these things run is ProPublica or Publica, as you call them.
It is ProPublica.
Is it?
Yeah.
ProPublica. They will report on something like this, and then the New York Times will, 3 days later, magically sort of come up with the same story
exactly.
And not cite ProPublica.
Yeah.
But once it gets into the Times and then the Post, then we'll start to see what the real implications are of this. And why this is, it's an important story in and of itself, but it raises for me the potential for the fact that there could have been a WFP challenge to Cuomo. We now see Zephyr Teachout and Wu, her running mate, are running against them in the primary. There's a whole other interesting story to that too. Particularly Wu and Hochul, lieutenant governor's race. But we'll talk about that at another time. Hopefully, we'll talk to Zephyr Teachout in the next day or two. You wrote a piece about it's cutting out. Okay. you wrote a piece in, I think it was Salon, about a new group that's starting that presented themselves to the AFT about fighting charters. And this whole sector, and part of it is just, you know, there are times where I project things onto, you know, what I want to, you know, happen. But I had a great interview with Barbara Maldioni from the new head of the Massachusetts Teachers Union. And in Chicago, it really does look like Karen Lewis, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union, is going to be running against Rahm Emanuel. There was a poll that came out the other day that showed that she was leading Emanuel, and that there was actually another councilwoman or county...
County board, kind of a county executive kind of thing. Tony Preckwinkle, who was up 24 points in that poll, but then has since said that she would not run.
And so it looks like Karen Lewis is going to run.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of things that are fascinating to me about this. One is, this is going to be, if she runs against Rahm Emanuel, this is going to be nationally for all of our ilk what a race against Cuomo could be. A surrogate to take out the frustration that we have on where we see the Democratic Party going in the wrong way, where we see the neoliberal agenda trumping. There's so many themes that can be applied and projected onto this race.
I would say a potential Lewis Emanuel race will be the most important thing to this segment of the liberal part of the country, as it will be as central as the Lieberman-Lamont race in 2006.
I agree.
And this is something that I think a lot of people have been waiting for, have been waiting around to see was there going to be a touchstone, was there going to be this focusing point that they could go to play out this battle almost for the soul of the Democratic Party.
The interesting thing is the election's going to fall, I think it's in February.
Yeah.
And so it's not going to, you know, between November and February,
right,
it is going to be crazy.
Yeah.
And the thing that's different between this race and Lieberman-Lamont is that Lieberman-Lamont was very much about sort of Joe Lieberman was undercutting the mainstream Democratic position. This Karen Lewis Rahm Emanuel is really more ideological.
Yeah.
Than Lieberman Lamont. I mean, Lieberman Lamont was
I would say that Karen Lewis is going to be a more credible bearer of a progressive message than Ned Lamont could ever have been.
Yes. I agree with that. And it also simply represents another thing that's happening with the teachers, with the teachers' unions, because they are fighting back against, you know, this is going to raise all sorts of issues about charters. It's also going to raise issues about unions, about, you know, because the Chicago Teachers Union story is really fascinating in the way that they adopted a social justice unionism as opposed to like a business unionism
model.
Trade
unionism model.
And
education is the area where there is the most, perhaps, dissension within the Democratic coalition. That there are large groups on either side of this divide between the so-called education reformers,
right,
who want high-stakes testing and performance evaluations, the elimination of tenure, charter schools, breaking of teachers' unions, and then this enormous base where teachers make up a huge part of the rank-and-file activist base of the Democratic Party, the people who stuff envelopes, the people who put together campaigns. So with those two forces in opposition, I just think it's a very natural way to pour all of that into one race that symbolizes, and it's not just that, it's also about Wall Street. It's about the fact that the Chicago School Board has all these interest rate swap deals with Wall Street. They're losing enough money on there that they wouldn't have had to close 60 schools in the last 2 years. They would have had enough money just from the money they're right. losing on those deals. It's about Rahm Emanuel and the dissatisfaction, perhaps, with the president
yep.
From some circles of the party, him being the chief of staff for the first couple years. There is so much wrapped up in an Emanuel-Lewis race that it really is about the soul of the party. Now, does that mean that one side or the other is that going to determine the victor in this race? No. It's going to be about lots and lots and lots of money.
Right.
Rahm Emanuel, after that poll came out, announced that he had raised for his super PAC $1 million from eight people, eight donors, the grassrootsiest of the grassroots. And that's only a taste of what's going to come and rain down upon the head of Karen Lewis should she decide to get in this race. So it's really about money versus people power. Even though I think that you could nationalize a Rahm Emanuel race in a second and collect millions of dollars
absolutely.
Across the country.
If my job was to raise money for the Karen Lewis campaign
right.
and I was getting a commission of that money, I would do quite well.
So,
I mean,
this is going to be very healthy for this kind of wayward progressive movement over the last couple years to have this debate
yep.
about education, about Wall Street, about the kinds of issues that affect cities. Because it's also about inequality and it's about poverty. It's going to be incredibly healthy for this movement to finally have a place to focus all of those concerns.
Yeah.
So it's something I'm going to be intently watching over the next several months.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. All right. Well, David Dayan, thanks so much for your time. We're going to take a quick break, folks, and then I'm not sure who...
It's a ready for Hillary pastry break is what it is.
I'm going to be taking a little a brownie break, and then we'll be back in just a moment. David Dayan, as always, a pleasure.
Thank you.
Folks, Sam Cedar, a Majority Report. We are live from Netroots Nation. Joining me is Jay Tomlinson from Best of the Left. Jay, welcome to the program. It's always fun to catch up with you at Netroots.
Yeah.
Tell us about Best of the Left.
Well, the compilation show brings together the Best of Left, as you might imagine, tries to be more valuable than the sum of its parts. Majority Report is often part of it.
Wait, and more valuable than the sum of its parts. I'm not sure.
Well, I bring together clips from lots of different shows, and all those parts collectively, I think, they tell a greater story than the individual segments do by themselves.
All right.
That's the magic of editing.
Yes, and you bring together, like, you generally do it by topic, right?
Right. Yeah, each episode is on a given topic. Lots of different voices come together talking about the similar thing from slightly different perspectives, and it it all comes together.
And you've been doing this for years, and we're people will recall that you were very helpful to this program when we launched, and I appreciate that immensely. And
I tried to be.
We get a lot of listeners who I think hear from the show from your show.
That's what I'm here for.
And all right, so what else? How many of these have you been to?
Netroots. I think this must be my fourth. First one was in Las Vegas, and I think that was 4 years ago. I feel like I'm getting the hang of it now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Give me your sense. I mean, have you seen a change over the past 4 years? I'm curious your perspective on it relative to someone who's been doing it for a long time.
Right. I only arrived, this morning, sort of easing into it a little bit there. My impression is sort of carrying over from last year that sort of the whole progressive vibe is a little bit on the, like, it's just way different than sort of the fire-breathing Bush era or anything along those lines, but kind of easing into the some of the disappointments of the Obama era and now looking forward, and there's a lot of talk about sort of the inevitability of Hillary that I'm not excited about. And,
right.
I think as the Obama administration looks towards its close, now we all get to fight about what the future is, because the future's been inevitable for a few years now.
I would say the future's been inevitable for always. What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, who the establishment is coalescing around and all. I mean, the Obama administration's been in there, and whether you're disappointed or not, that's kind of who we're stuck with the Democrats, and so you can not be excited about the Democrats, but at the end of the day, that's kind of
right
what you're faced with. So,
well, I mean, time will tell. It is interesting to see sort of how people are adjusting to that, and it doesn't quite seem like anything's happening here in terms of 2016.
Not yet. Okay,
except
good.
For the snack booth.
Okay, good.
Which is,
well, that's the only thing I've visited so far, so I assumed that.
Right.
Yeah.
And I am definitely eating my way through the snack bar. But Jay, thank you so much for stopping by. I wanted to say hello, and we will be we'll catch up. You and I will do a little
sounds
drinking,
good.
And we're doing a meetup here. Are you part of this meetup?
I am. I didn't know you were.
I didn't know I was either. When is it? It's tonight?
7 o'clock tonight at the Anchor Bar.
Okay, yes. Somebody told me that I was. Pac-Man said I was.
He's probably mistaken. But if you show up, we won't kick you out.
All right. Fair enough. So, folks, if you're in Detroit, the Anchor Bar tonight at 7 p.m. All right. We're going to take just a quick break. We'll be right back. folks, we're still here at Netroots Nation. Today it is Thursday, and we're going to take a break and say goodbye to our freebie folks. Tomorrow we'll have a Freebie Friday, and tomorrow on the program, Charlie Pierce will be here. We'll be talking, I think, to Stephanie Kelton, who is around. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I am on the air, so I've got people literally yelling at me, and we're buried here in the back, and some of the folks I had scheduled, I think, have not found the booth. All right, so we're going to take a break. Remember, folks, it is your membership which supports this program, and by becoming a member at Majority.fm, you ensure that we continue. Oh, wait. You know what? Okay, good. hold on. We're going to do one more interview here. And joining me is Lily Escalin Garcia.
That is so close. You get a B plus.
I get a B.
Yeah, but you got the Garcia right, and Lily is really, yeah, I was Miss Lily, the music lady, so that's really as far as we need to go.
Okay.
Nobody gets Eskelson. That's Eskelson, asking too much.
Okay. the new president of, or the president-elect, I should
yes.
say, of the NEA.
How cool is that?
Well, you know, last time I spoke to you, you were... the vice president.
Yeah.
When do you become actual president?
September 1. I have a fabulous president in Dennis Van Rockel, who basically said, as far as I'm concerned, you have a new title. It's president-elect. You get out there and you let people know what the NEA is all about and what we're trying to do for our students.
All right. Well, what is it about? I mean, you guys are I don't know in terms of the size.
The largest labor union of any type in the country, and we are 3 million strong. We are educators who work in America's public schools, colleges, and universities.
And, I mean, so how is it divided up between the AFT, the American Federations of Teachers?
Mechanically,
that work?
Totally different organization, but we work so closely on so many issues. So AFT is pretty much in a lot of the larger cities, like Chicago and New York City. And we have been mostly a state-based affiliate. So we have 1,200 school districts in all 50 states.
Okay. And now, recently, the NEA has been in the news in regards to the Obama administration. Do tell.
It is job one for me, and when I ran and asked for my colleagues at our representative assembly to support my candidacy, I made it very clear that for me, job one was to move a whole child movement to something better for students, something away from the toxic testing where a whole and blessed child is everything you need to know about them, according to No Child Left Untested, is their cut score on a math and reading
right.
test. And that's it. That has been the stumbling block, the wall, the brick wall that we're trying to break through. It has become a growing frustration with educators in every state, what testing absurdities have popped up, things that are really hurting kids. In Oklahoma alone, 8,000 third graders missed the cut score on a reading test. So nothing else that they did all year long matters. Because of the testing regime, they can't go to fourth grade. 8,000. 1,000 kids were told they were failures because they were a few points off of the cut score. That's ridiculous. We're seeing
And this implicates funding of schools. This implicates the security of teachers.
Exactly. And it's not just our security we're worried about. Against all evidence, the Department of Education has given incentives to states to say, and, you know, let's make those test scores not only stop a third grader from going to fourth grade or a high school senior from graduating, let's judge and label their teachers as effective or not. I taught at a homeless shelter school in Salt Lake City. I taught a class of 39 fifth graders one year. And I also taught the gifted and talented summer school. Very different results. Same teacher. I'll bet if all you knew were the cut scores on the standardized tests of my kids in the shelter who didn't speak English and went to school 1 or 2 months that year, you would think you were looking at two different teachers.
Right.
So these kinds of things are unreliable, and they're causing not just absurdities, they are corrupting what it means to teach and what it means to learn.
So let's talk about the call for Arne Duncan's resignation. This seems to have been a function of his reaction. I mean, I imagine a lot of issues behind this, but his reaction to the Viagra case in California, where a federal court basically said, or I should say a state court, said that the scheme, if you will, for providing teachers with tenure, and not tenure in the way that they can never be fired, but tenure meaning that after they get due process and they're fired, was thrown out and found to be discriminatory in a case that a lot of people think is sort of ridiculous and going to be overturned in appeal. But Arne Duncan came out and was applauding this. There seems to be a dynamic in this country where... And I've talked to many educators. To a person, they have all basically said, I can tell you how the school performs based upon what the average income is in any given district. And that instead of dealing with poverty, what we're now doing is blaming teachers for poverty's impacts on education.
You've got it right on. Because what we have found, and why this was so upsetting to us, is people are using find the bad teacher to mean we have no intention of actually dealing with the inequality in public schools. So if you can find the bad teacher, it doesn't matter if the roof's leaking. It doesn't matter that there's 39 kids in a classroom. If you can find the bad teacher, then you don't have to worry about, here's a school that has the arts and a computer lab and a fabulous library, and look at the neighborhoods that don't have those things. We can just go, you know, if you had a good enough teacher, none of those things would matter, and we have no intention of funding any of those things. So it has been the excuse, this mythical, just find the bad teacher, has been something that has appalled us, because it has gotten us off of really talking about what kids need to have an equitable shot at something called a good education. And for Secretary Duncan, and I've had a talk with him in the last couple days, he's very upset about how we feel. And we're very upset about why we feel that way. So the one thing that we agreed on is we really do have to listen to each other. He wants a lot of credit for things that he deserves credit for, things like I fought for early childhood education and affordable college, and that is absolutely true, and I want to give a shout out for that. I also want to say none of that will matter if we use early childhood education to teach four-year-olds to bubble in an answer sheet with their small muscle skills, if we keep graduating high school seniors who are really good test guessers, but they didn't get the math, they didn't get the science, they didn't get the arts, they didn't get the sports that they needed. They aren't critical creative thinkers because you can't put that on a multiple choice test.
Right.
So when you start defining what a good teacher and a bad teacher is, we also know that there are plenty of people who would love to say, you know what, let's do away with this little thing called due process, where if you feel like someone wanted to fire you because their kid didn't make the team, that we can just look at your students' test scores and we can tell if you're a good teacher or a bad teacher. And we can fire people over test scores. The insidiousness of this testing insanity is what has to change.
There's a great piece in this month's New Yorker which talks about the massive cheating scandal that happened in Georgia.
It's corruption waiting to happen. It's corruption in process.
Yes. Well, Lily Eskelson Garcia, the president-elect of the NEA, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you
really
so much.
I
always enjoy it.
All right, folks, and joining me now is not going to be Shannon Moore. She is going to join me tomorrow. All right, fair enough. But we do have, we have Chris Savage from Eclecta Blog, not Electa Blog, is going to be joining us. And Chris, of course, is from Detroit and blogs on all things Michigan. Chris, give us a welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Give us a sense of what's happening in Detroit now in terms of the water shutoffs. I have seen reports that Canadians have crossed the border with providing water.
It's outrageous. The UN now has issued a condemnation of this, as a matter of fact, which is the first time that we're aware that the UN has ever intervened in this way at the state level. So that's, it's pretty remarkable. Really, it's the first time I've ever heard of, and I think probably in history, where a municipality has shut off water supply to thousands, literally thousands, over 10,000 people because of unpaid bills. And these bills, some of them go way back. Some of these people are being hit with bills that are in the hundreds or thousands of dollars that they can't pay. Meanwhile, we've got major city-run and corporate groups that are getting away with this. Ford Field, for example, owes a lot of money. Joe Louis Arena owes a lot of money, way more money than these individuals do. And so they're, this is a real human rights crisis for a lot of people.
And so what's happening here in terms of it? I mean, I've seen a group called the Detroit Water Brigade is actually getting involved in direct action. What can you tell me about that?
So the Detroit Water Brigade is really taking a leadership role on this, as well as another group in the Moratorium Now, and basically saying, look, this is a human rights crisis. We have to stop this. There's a way to figure this out. This isn't the way to do it by just this draconian action. And also calling on, calling for some accountability on the banks and stuff that sort of have brought Detroit or helped Detroit down into the pit that it's in right now financially. So it's sort of a two-pronged thing. There's a rally tomorrow at noon. It's going to start here at Cobo and go over to Hart Plaza. There'll be a variety of speakers there just trying to draw attention to this. And it really is drawing national, international attention in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, you've got some of the highest water prices in the country. And I understand that dynamic because they have lost a lot of their customer base and they have an infrastructure that, but at the same time, how do you cut off water to people? I just don't understand how you do that.
This is a story that gets retold in Detroit over and over again, where something has happened out of the control of the local residents, but they're paying the price for that thing. So whether it's fiscal mismanagement by city leaders or, robber barons, basically, want to call them that, in terms of the banks that are coming in and doing, foreclosures and, getting people into loans that they can't afford or whatever it is. These things were not, the city workers, the unions, the pensioners, none of these people are responsible for these problems, but they're the ones that are being made to pay the price for it.
What is happening with the Detroit pensions now?
I'm not an expert on this, but what I can tell you is that there is a deal being wrangled right now through the bankruptcy court to... There would be a small cut to the pensioners, but I think it's roughly 3 or 4%. It's fairly minimal, and that's done because they brought in a lot of outside groups to help fund, for example, the DIA, the Detroit Institute of Arts, and it literally is a grand bargain with a lot of different players in it. Right now, that's gone before, that's been out to vote by the pensioners, so they have to vote to approve that, and there has to be buy-in by all the different groups, so we'll see.
So we're not going to be selling off the Detroit museums?
that's probably not going to happen. You know, it's funny when rich people start to feel the pinch on things, suddenly they become interested in the issues, and that's one issue that has gotten their attention.
Right, right. You don't want to live in a city where you literally are telling people that you're selling off.
But
the
artwork. On the other hand, with the water thing, there's a real potential they're going to sell off the Detroit Water Works, and if they do that, if they privatize that, the short-term effect is a quick infusion of cash, but the long-term impact is that you've got a private group now controlling the water supply for Detroit, and you know there's plenty of evidence that in the long term will not actually lower
Chicago
prices.
Parking meters. Of course, it is one thing to have private control of your parking meters, even though it ends up costing the city, I think, close to $900.
Nice.
$1 billion or $1 million, I can't remember, over the course of whatever this lease was. And also you lose control of the parking meters. The whole issue was that they couldn't raise the fees, and then the private company comes in. They immediately raise the fees.
Of course they do. And they do that, and it's a
and
fee.
And if
so
it's water, then we're talking about something very, very different.
You absolutely are. You're talking about people's survival. When they privatized, I believe it's Pontiac's water system, they privatized it to United Water, which is an international conglomerate, and that group had recently been cited, like in the past year, for these gross infractions in terms of like massively chlorinating right before their E. coli tests and then turning them back down again afterwards and that kind of stuff. And you know, when I broke that story, people were just shocked that this emergency manager just was going to basically give the water supply to this corporation. So it's
well, but if you get E. coli from water. From your water system, according to libertarian principles, the bottom line is, at the end of the day, you just don't get your water from that one supplier of water.
Right, you go to the next water. Guy. Oh, there is no other next
right.
guy.
Right. Chris Savage of Eclectablog, thank you so much
for
your
here.
Time.
Appreciate,
thanks, appreciate it. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein I will take your IMs and... perhaps maybe I can take your phone calls. I don't know if I can do that, actually, but maybe I can. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
C'est une poupée qui fait noir. C'est une poupée.